Good morning. It is Sunday, May 5th, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
The KUAF website giveaway is offering tickets to three of the area's largest concert festivals. You could win tickets to Rocklahoma, Wakarusa, or the country music festival Thunder on the Mountain, all during the month of May. Separate registration for each concert giveaway is required. Details and registration available on the web at KUAF.com.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks at Large, how a University of Arkansas researcher is partnering with researchers from around the world to study a rare bird in Asia. Plus, Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art has a new partner for their first ever temporary outdoor sculpture. But speaking of partnerships, many more partnerships were in the news and this week, and with his usual week in review, Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis.
Several of our news headlines this past week related at least in part to partnerships in the area, either being formed or otherwise evolving. For example, Arkansas House Minority Leader Greg Letting, a Democrat from Fayetteville, says lawmakers managed to pull together by the end of the session and pass some major legislation. In an interview with Talk Business Arkansas, Letting said some of the partisanship at the beginning of the session did not stop progress.
I know that early on in the sessions, the first half was dominated largely by some of the reproductive rights and guns issues and things like that, and those got a lot of attention, but there was definitely a point midway through the session. I think it was the day the speaker even went around to make it clear to the committees he wanted to shift the tone, and I think we saw that, and I think the back half of the session, we did focus more on education, jobs, and obviously Medicaid.
Letting said the General Assembly was so evenly split that both sides had to ultimately listen to and work with each other, creating a partnership in order to accomplish anything. Republicans held a 51-48 advantage over Democrats in the 100-member House, and Letting says Democrats have a good chance of taking back the chamber in 2014. This week, the Army Corps of Engineers and the Beaver Lake Foundation officially began a different kind of partnership meant to benefit all lake users. Sean Harper, the Corps' operations manager for Beaver Lake, says that the foundation will be able to offer additional resources, such as fundraising and attracting volunteers, to help with projects at the lake.
You know, our budget is fairly fixed. It's certainly not increasing in any kind of a way. So, you know, we've got an aging infrastructure. We've got parks on Beaver Lake that are, you know, they're approaching 50 years old in just a few years. And a lot of this stuff just needs a lot of TLC. And with our decreased buying power through the federal budget process, we're looking for partners that can help us. The most important thing is that we have facilities on Beaver Lake that are, you know, they're accessible, they're safe to use, that they meet the needs of the public. And, you know, we're reaching out to a partner like Beaver Lake Foundation to help us make sure that we reach that we're able to sustain that here at Beaver Lake.
Harper says that an example of a project that the partnership could help with is the creation of life jacket stations at every beach on the lake. He says that though the Corps was able to find enough money to build one such life jacket station last year, and possibly two more this year, the partnership with the Beaver Lake Foundation has the potential of doubling the Corps' capable construction.
It's beyond our capability within our own budget to just take all that on at one time. The foundation has indicated that they have an interest in maybe trying to do some fundraising and to acquire some funds and maybe some volunteer folks who could help both acquire and then construct these. And then the partnership, the Corps has the equipment to go and actually, you know, drill the holes and install these life jacket loaner stations out there above the beaches. So that's kind of the partnership effort on that particular case. The foundation has indicated they're going to try to do that, raise some money, get these things built, and then the Corps will take them and go install them.
More generally speaking, though, the goal of the Beaver Lake Foundation is to support Corps operations and recreation at the lake. And the city of Bella Vista is scheduled to change its partnership with the city's library as the city is set to take over operations of the Bella Vista Library next year. The move comes after a 4-1 city council decision in favor of making the change. The move comes after a 4-1 city council decision in favor of making the library a city-managed department. Frank Anderson, mayor of Bella Vista, says the city already provides partial support for the library, giving it about $125,000 this year. Taking control of the library would take a larger budget than that, however.
total budget for the library to operate on a similar schedule to the way it operates right now would be about 260 or 270. So we're talking about doubling the input plus 10 or 15,000. We think we can do that on into the future and then see what we want to do. There is such a thing as a library property tax that a few cities in Northwest Arkansas have passed. That would be one way to develop a revenue stream on out into the future.
Anderson says that a library tax is probably 5 or 6 years from being a reality in Bella Vista. And the push for the city to take over the library came out of a 7-person ad hoc committee formed to look at services currently offered in the city but provided by nonprofit organizations formed prior to Bella Vista's incorporation.
Their recommendation was that the library was struggling a little bit with its total donation policy, getting no funding from any other source, basically, and that it probably could not perpetuate itself forever. It wasn't in dire straits, was not going to collapse immediately, but probably would have difficulty in the future. They also took a look, and based on the focus groups and the input from citizens, it was something that a city our size should definitely have.
Anderson says the committee is looking at the possibility of the city taking over other services currently offered by nonprofits, including the Bella Vista Historical Museum and the Bella Vista Animal Shelter. And finally, Eureka Springs is the latest city in the region to be accredited as a National Main Street program. The Eureka Springs Downtown Network announced this week that the National Main Street Center has accredited the organization. Jacqueline Wolven, director of the Eureka Springs Downtown Network, says that the organization had to meet several requirements before it could become accredited.
One of the things that's required is you have to have a part-time director. You need to have a complete work plan, which we have. We needed to grow our budget from that smaller, very tight budget that the Downtown Network was to, in our sense, larger budget. Has to be over $50,000, which was a big step for us, actually. And then there were just some other organizational things that needed to happen.
In addition, Wolven says that the Eureka Springs Downtown Network will eventually need to find permanent physical office space in the downtown area. She says the program's accreditation brings benefits, including more assistance and resources from the Main Street Arkansas organization.
So if we want to have small business consulting or window design or any of the services that they offer, we're able to do that now for all of our businesses within the district at no cost at an unlimited amount. As a downtown network, we were only able to offer that 4 times a year, which is a huge difference. Now, when new businesses come in, we're able to give this whole toolbox of things that they can have, as opposed to piecing them out one by one.
Another benefit that Wolven says comes with accreditation is the boost in reputation that comes with being affiliated with Main Street programs at the state and national levels. She says that the additional resources available will help bolster the Eureka Springs Downtown Network's partnership with businesses and other organizations in Eureka Springs. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
You may be familiar with Leo Villarreal's work. He's the guy that designed the $10 million Bay Lights project on the San Francisco Bay Bridge that was turned on in March. The lights that line the concourse connecting the east and west buildings of the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. are his work, as well as the Bleecker Street subway station in New York City. Villarreal uses LED lights, technology, and custom computer programming in his site-specific designs. His work can now be seen at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville. Buckyball is the first temporary outdoor installation for the museum. The project gets its name from Buckminster Fuller, a 20th century architect and creator of a geodesic dome, from which Villarreal got his inspiration. I spoke with Villarreal. I began by asking him how the piece, originally designed for and commissioned by Madison Square Park Conservancy in New York City, fits into the very different landscape of Crystal Bridges.
Well, the piece was originally conceived for a very urban environment right in the center of Manhattan in a wonderful park surrounded by skyscrapers. But for me, it's really thrilling to see it in a completely different context and see the work, the way the work can travel. And, you know, here it's presented in nature and it's visible, you know, from a very long distance, which it wasn't in New York, you know, at the end of a field and right at the entrance to this wonderful museum. So I'm really thrilled. And judging from people's responses as we've been testing, you know, there's just kind of a excitement and everyone wants to know what it is. And it's really attracting so many people. And that's great. Very exciting for me.
I was thinking, I watched a video of the Bucky, of the changing lights and the colors and whatnot, and there was music to it. And as you were talking about how this was designed for skyscrapers, the sound is very different. The sounds out here are much different than downtown New York City.
Absolutely. I mean, and here, just hearing the incredible soundscape of the crickets and frogs, and that's a wonderful sound as well. And I couldn't help but make relationships between what I was hearing and what I was saying. You know, it's a different thing that I'm you know, excited to spend more time watching and listening to.
When you were approached by Madison Square Park to, you were commissioned to do this piece, how did you come up with the idea? Did you know of a buckyball? How did you know that was what you wanted to do?
Well, I've been working with geometry from pretty much the beginning of making my light sculpture. So I've always had an interest in that. And I remember seeing my first buckyball in the Science Times of the New York Times, and noted the form, and it was intriguing to me, the interaction of the hexagon and the pentagon, and that it was also dimensional. It was a sphere. And that's generally the trend that, you know, I've been seeing in my work is moving more towards sculpture and getting off the wall and starting to really engage with space. So the buckyball seemed like the perfect form to explore.
Well, you mentioned that you've always worked with geometry. Were you first kind of into math and technology before you were into art, or was it kind of vice versa?
I started out in art and studying sculpture. I mean, I'd always been interested in technology from my early days with an Apple II Plus computer. And for me, it's really about art first and using these amazing tools to create art. So I use software that's all customized and to generate the sequences that I'm making. So I'm very deeply involved in developing a lot of this, you know, very technical stuff. But that's what I need to do in order to create my work.
How is technology and computer programming, how is that art?
Well, it's you know, it's just another tool. Like, it just happens to be very contemporary, and I think artists have always been attracted to new tools and new technology. What I'm doing is connecting software with light, so I'm not presenting things on a screen or as a projection in the way that you would show a lot of new media work. I'm dealing directly with light, which has the ability to be very impactful and to have a strong, you know, really engage a viewer's sensorium. So that's what I love about art, is the impact of it.
Mentions computer programming. How long did it take to program the buckyball to change into so many different colors? I mean, it's how many colors? 16 million. Wow.
So we have the form of the buckyball, but it's lined with LED tubes, and within the tubes there are red, green, and blue LEDs. And I can make every 1.2 inches of the tubes a different color, any of 16 million colors. So that's the range that I have to work with. So I'm moving light around the sphere. In order to do that, I had to create custom tools that allow me to create those color combinations and sequences. So I did a lot of that beforehand, and then had to sit in front of the piece in Madison Square Park for, I had a week to really work on it and to tune it, because it's really about being present with the piece and tuning it.
So is the tune here at Crystal Bridges, is it different than what people saw at Madison Square Park?
There have been some subtle differences. I've had a couple of nights here to work with the piece and to make some adjustments, which I'm not sure if anyone will really notice, anyone besides me, but it's always great to be able to revisit a piece and to see how it can evolve.
Well, you mentioned night, and so it's a light thing, so obviously it's easier seen at night. But I stopped by on my way in, and it's on. I mean, I could notice the lights changing, even in this very, very bright sunlight that we're in. Do you intend for viewers to see it during the day also? Or, you know, how is it different, the viewing?
Well, I think One thing I'm pleased with is that the Buckyball is it's a beautiful sculpture and form, even without the lights on, and that's important to me, is that it look good at all times. But the piece is a light sculpture, and it's hard to compete with the sun. So it's best viewed starting at 8 p.m., and it'll be on until 10:30 p.m. each night. During the day, the piece is on and doing a very simple sequence using white light. We call it thinking mode, where it's saying that it's on and active, but it's not as impactful as it is certainly in the evening. So it really comes to life as it gets darker.
So I know that when I was watching a video of it, I wasn't in New York while it was there, but it kind of puts you in a trance a little bit, kind of mesmerizing a little bit. What is the intended, I guess, feeling that you're trying to evoke in people that are viewing it?
All my work is abstract. I'm not dealing with images or text. So I'm interested in rules and underlying structures and in working with the form. But I think that a lot of the sequences do have a lot of personality, and they feel very much alive, and it's exciting to watch them and try and decode them. The brain can't help but pattern recognize. That's how we're hardwired to do that. So we're getting some information. We want to make sense of it, but it doesn't quite resolve. And it's also highly subjective. Everyone will see something different in the piece. But I think it's operating in the way that a fire would. And sometimes I've referred to my pieces as digital campfires. So there's this communal aspect. And in the way that you'd want to be near a fire, you want to be near the Buckyball, because it's ambient and it's doing something and it's pleasurable to be with. And it's also nice to be able to share that experience. And that's why I built these zero gravity couches that surround the Buckyball, so people can have a place to recline and to really spend some time with the piece.
A lot of you earlier when we were in the conversation, you mentioned getting things off the wall. And so a lot of your pieces are very site specific. I mean, you have the Bay Lights, the Bleecker Street. So you're taking a place that doesn't have anything and you're adding something to it. What are people's comments on how you've changed the atmosphere of a place?
Well, for me, my interest is in augmenting and adding something and working with the systems that are already at work, whether it's architecture or landscape. And all the inspiration for the sequencing comes from the site and the kinetic activity around. So I'm kind of creating, the pieces become almost like mirrors and somehow reflect on where they are. So that's my general intention. I think that what's been interesting for me is to see the universal quality that the pieces have. Anyone can look at it and engage, because light is something that we all have a very strong relationship with and can have some response to. So I think that there's an ability to access a very large audience. That's certainly thrilling for me.
Just really quickly, have you ever been to Northwest Arkansas before, and what do you think of our museum here?
Now, I've never been to Arkansas. This is my first trip. The closest I've been is Kansas City, where I did a piece several years ago. I'm thrilled to be here and to discover this museum, which is just extraordinary. The quality of the art and the architecture and the spirit of the institution is very inspiring in the way that it seeks to really broaden the audience for art. And I think it's very much aligned with my dedication to public art.
Leo Villarreal's Buckyball can be viewed near the entrance to Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville on the Orchard Trail over the coming months.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Palace's fish eagle is not a bird well known to many of us here, partly because the relative of the bald eagle is found halfway across the world, partly because it is disappearing, and partly because only a handful of researchers are studying the magnificent creature. One of those researchers is Marla Steele, a doctoral student in biological sciences at the University of Arkansas.
Well, I came to the University of Arkansas in the fall of 2010. And I came into Dr. Douglas James' lab, and I knew that I wanted to do research on raptors in Asia.
As an undergraduate, she was offered and accepted an invitation to present a paper on her work about Asian raptors at the 6th Annual Conference of the Asian Raptor Research and Conservation Network in Mongolia.
And in Mongolia, I really hit it off with the head of the ornithology lab there, Dr. Sundev Gombobatar. And so we got to talking about his work in Mongolia. And while I had been familiar with Japan and a little bit of Thailand, I had never really even imagined what it was like in Mongolia. And next thing I know, after spending a week there with the conference, I fell in love with the country overall.
This week, Marla Steele came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to talk about her future research plans, including an ambitious project that will be completed, she hopes, with crowdfunding. At the webpage dedicated to the effort, there is a video Marla made that includes footage of the rare bird, Indiana Jones-style graphics, and dramatic music. Marla Steele says the window for studying the Pallas's fish eagle is fleeting. It's believed there are fewer than 10,000 left.
Yeah, it's listed under the IUCN Red List as globally vulnerable, which means that there could be anywhere from 1,000 to 9,999 birds. The problem is we have a deceptively large range. The bird's original range extended all the way out from the Caspian Sea to the middle of China, and then finally to southernmost Russia, all the way down to Myanmar and the Indian subcontinent in the northern section. So it has a very massive range, which makes it deceptive. And we're thinking, okay, we see 15 to 20 in Mongolia, and then we see maybe 45 breeding pairs in India, and we think the bird's fine. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, though, when you start looking at each country, and the majority of the countries have been extirpated, they're just not there anymore.
And there's precious little known about their migratory habits, right?
Right. There's been a lot of speculation as far as, okay, we've seen the birds here during the summer, and they tend to disappear around, September. They can appear anywhere from April to May in Mongolia and disappear by September. And so it's obvious that they're migratory. They haven't been seen in the winter. But as to where they go, nobody knows. Same thing with India. They know they breed during the winter in India, which is complete opposite in Mongolia. And so they're here somewhere anywhere from October to March, but by March, some of them just disappear and nobody knows where they're going. And overall, there hasn't been a single comprehensive study on the migration habits of Pallas's fish eagles.
The fact that it's listed as a vulnerable species, studying the migration habits, trying to find out more, could help it become less vulnerable? Is that the hope, the desire?
Right. As of now, the bird is declining very rapidly. And the problem is you can't conserve a species if you don't know where it's going 6 months out of the year. So aside from not knowing its migration habits, we also have no clue what its non-breeding habitat requirements are. And again, if we don't know this information, how can we possibly make a proper conservation plan to protect it?
How difficult is it to see one if they're declining and there's such a big range?
It depends on where you look. And as far as the protected national parks, like say in India, Kaziranga National Park, or even Jim Corbett National Park, which is a pretty well-known tourist destination in India, they're protected national parks, which some people, especially in Jim Corbett, they're not even allowed to get out of the Jeep. They have to stay inside the Jeep, and they are not allowed to interfere with the wildlife whatsoever. So that gives it a very nice protected habitat because they may very well be very sensitive to human disturbance. You go outside of the national parks, however, though, and it's significantly harder to find the birds. My recent field season back in India in March 2013, we were wandering all over the place in Haryana, and we saw maybe one bird. And it because of all these people running around the wetlands and the rivers, it would not come down. It would just kind of soar overhead briefly and disappear.
Do you remember the first time you saw one in the field?
Oh, yeah. I remember it very, very clearly. Of course, I'd spent hours upon hours looking at this bird and hearing sound clips of its call, but there's nothing quite like seeing it for the first time. I had gone to Jim Corbett National Park by myself and talked to some of the locals, the local birders who knew about this bird and knew who might be able to help me find it. So I hired a local guide and driver, and he took me to the top of this mountain, and we just overlooked the Kosi River, and he pointed out far in the distance. He said, "There's a nest right there in that tree." By the time I just identified the nest, very carefully nestled in between the three branches of a red silk cotton tree, I hear this wonderful yet terribly obnoxious call. If you could imagine a squeaky fishing tackle combined with the carefree call of a seagull, that would be the magnificence that is a Pallas's fish eagle right there. So I hear this call, and right there in between the valley of two mountains, it's just soaring over the river and goes directly to the nest. And to my eyes, surprise, what do I see after seeing that eagle go into the nest? But there are two chicks.
You mentioned the call. You called it sort of squeaky fishing tackle and a seagull. When we see an eagle in a movie, it's this majestic sort of cry. So what does this sound that you're describing? No, it's not what we're used to in Hollywood?
I'll tell you a secret. That majestic, just fierce cry that you hear in the majority of movies, it's not even an eagle at all. It's actually a red-tailed hawk, which is a very common hawk in North America,
yeah.
But it's not an eagle. It's a bootio.
So here is the real sound of a Pallas's fish eagle collected by Matthias Richard. Marla plans to go back to further study the bird, and she has a plan to use amazing technology to track the Pallas's fish eagle's migration patterns.
My ultimate goal is, since we don't know where these birds are going, and since it has such a deceptively large range, and it's could possibly be a very long-distance migrant, we have to use the employment of satellite technology to track them. So we have GSM GPS transmitters, and what it does is it takes GPS satellites and it collects its coordinates. Depending on the battery, it can collect it every 2 to 5 minutes for 18 meters at a time with both height, both horizontal and vertical location. And it transmits that data directly to my computer through GSM cell towers. I mean, essentially, I'm getting a text message from Pallas's fish eagle.
Wherever you are?
Wherever I am, as far as my computer.
To that end, she has a crowdsourcing website at indiegogo.com. with different perks for different levels of contributions. For example, $5 will receive a personal thank you note, $250 a signed field sketch of the bird, and the top level, $3,600, gives somebody naming rights to an individual tracked eagle.
Right now with our previous fundraiser, we were able to raise funds for two GSM units, and those units are going to go on eagles in Mongolia. But unfortunately, that only covers the northern range. And since we have two different distinct breeding seasons, the northern population breeds in the summer and the southern population breeds in the winter, we need at least two units for India as well. So within the next 6 months, we're going to try and raise as much funds as we can so we can purchase those GSM units and figure out where the birds are going.
You can find a link to the website Marla has started that includes her short video at ozarksatlarge.com.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now is Becca Martin Brown. She's features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Interesting art installation in Eureka Springs.
Okay.
You know it's May Fine Arts Month.
Right. Yeah, it is.
And every year they come up with something fascinating. This year it's a project called Mugs.
Coffee mugs?
No.
Beer
faces.
Mugs. Oh.
John Rankin, who is an artist and photographer, convinced artists in Eureka Springs to come and have their photos taken, making silly faces.
How fun.
And then they kind of turned them into a postery black and white look, did a huge poster that says, like, John Rankin, photographer, May Fine Arts Month, and they put them up all over town. And they did it kind of sneakily.
So you won't know where they are or where you might see them.
And they appeared all at once on the morning of May 1st.
Okay.
Poof. Just like that. They're everywhere. And you will find interesting people that you didn't know. You knew the name. You didn't know the face. And this might not be the face they would have chosen for you to see. But how fun that they were willing to do it.
Good people over there in Eureka.
Absolutely. The exhibit continues through May. And then on the 24th, everybody's meeting at 3 o'clock at Basin Park. They're going to be handed magic markers.
And you get to draw on the
pictures. You get to go graffiti the posters.
Devil horns and mustaches.
How fun is that? Also going on the 11th, there's a student art wall unveiling at 2 o'clock. On the 12th, John Two Hawks is presenting his free Mother's Day concert at the Eureka Springs City Auditorium. The White Street Art Walk is May 17th. Books in Bloom is May 19th at the Crescent Hotel. And the Basin Park Art Festival is May 25th. And they're opening a new music park in Eureka Springs, being unveiled by Trout Fishing in America. It's the North Main Street Parking Lot and City Park.
Okay.
So you'll find out about that later in the month. And on the 25th, Trout Fishing in America will be in concert at the Eureka Springs City Auditorium at 7 in the evening. It'll be a fun month, and we'll have lots more in What's Up all month long. Also this afternoon, the Prima Trio plays as part of the Live on Stage in Northwest Arkansas season at 2 o'clock at the Air and Art Center in Bentonville. Tickets are $5 for students and $30 for adults. It's Tontytown Heritage Day from 1 to 4 o'clock in downtown Tontytown.
Spaghetti?
I don't think so.
No.
But it's a nice thought.
Okay.
Jesus Christ Superstar wraps up at 2 o'clock at White Auditorium at Northwest Arkansas Community College. Tickets are $6 to $8. The Crawford County Chronicles series continues at the Drennan Scott Historic Site in Van Buren. This is a return to something I believe they started last fall, but it's the first one for the spring. Fred Williams will speak on Columbus, not the guy, the community that predated Van Buren. That's at 2 o'clock in Van Buren. There's a tableside theater show at 4 at Acoustic Mud in Bella Vista. It's got to be funny because the title's awesome.
What's the title?
Murder on the Oriental Rug.
Okay.
Gotta love it. $25 includes dessert.
As opposed to the Orient Express.
Exactly.
Yeah. Took me a second. Got it.
And Delbert McClinton, three-time Grammy winner, is back in Northwest Arkansas. I keep thinking this show is at the Amp, but it's not. It's at the Walton Arts Center. Starts at 7 o'clock. He's known for backing up blues greats such as Howlin' Wolf and Jimmy Reed. He just won a recent Grammy in Best Contemporary Blues Album category. And tickets are $25 to $75 for his show at 443-5600 or waltonartscenter.org.
And Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Christina, Artisphere has kicked off.
It has.
All over Northwest Arkansas. Visual arts, music, the gamut.
Mm-hmm. All having to do with nature.
Right, how the arts and nature work together. Tomorrow night at Thorn Crown Chapel, speaking of things that work with nature, architecture and nature there, Jamie Stone's Room of Wonders will perform. A few tickets were left Friday. I don't know if there are any yet, but I think after you hear them perform, you might be interested. Jamie and his bandmates, a quartet. Room of Wonders. Jamie Stone's Room of Wonders is how they're billed. They came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio Friday morning. We heard most of that on the Friday daily edition of Ozarks at Large. But here's one song that we didn't have enough time to hear the whole thing on during the daily show.
Andrea Berger.
Thank you.
Jamie Stone's Room of Wonders performing inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio Friday morning at the Carver Center for Public Radio. They will perform at Thorncrown Chapel tomorrow night in Eureka Springs. You can learn more about Jamie at his website, jamiestone.com. And remember, that's spelled J-A-Y-M-E, jamiestone.com.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. It is the fifth day of the fifth month, Cinco de Mayo in some places. And joining me now is Dr. Edmund Harris. He is professor of math at the University of Arkansas. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. And you're here to talk about the number five.
Yep.
Thought it was appropriate. So I don't know. What's unique about the number five? I know, you know, counting by fives, 5, 10, 15, 20.
That goes back to the fact we have four fingers and a thumb on our hands. And so our counting system uses tens, and five is half of 10.
Right.
And so it's sometimes a more convenient number to use. And of course, in the old tally systems, people would make four marks and then put a diagonal across them to make five and put them in clumps of five. So from that point of view, it was considered as a good unit. And that's probably just because we have four fingers and a thumb on our hands. So
it just kind of worked out that way.
More anthropological than mathematical.
Right. Really. How funny, because, yeah, I really never did, which is kind of silly that I've never thought about it. But, yeah, you do the hash marks with the line through it. Yeah, it's five. Five fingers, five toes. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, what else?
Well, I mean, one of the obvious ones is it's a prime number.
Okay, which means?
Which means it's only divisible by itself and one.
Okay.
It's one of the numbers that's very easy to divide by, again, for the same reason we've just been discussing, because our system uses tens, and tens are just two fives. It's easy to divide by five because you divide by 10 and multiply by two, for example. That's one easy trick. I think the most interesting thing about five, though, is some of its geometric properties.
The shape,
the pentagon. Mm-hmm. And it's the first number to have sort of more than one shape you can naturally draw. So if you take a triangle and you join up, well, all three points of the triangle are joined to both the other points. So if I take any corner of a triangle, that's connected to both other corners.
Okay.
If I take a square, I can join points on the diagonal. But the two diagonals don't give me an additional shape. They give me a sort of X.
Well, if you did one diagonal, you have two triangles.
Yeah.
Right?
But those would be triangles and not...
Right, not a square.
Not four-pointed. But if you take a pentagon, I can, as well as joining the points up to the next one round, I can sort of jump two round. So if I drew a pentagon and the points were one, and labeled the points 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 going round, instead of jumping 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 and then back to 1, I could instead jump from 1 to 3 to 5 to 2 to 4 and then back to 1.
So can we draw a pentagon? I'm like trying to picture it in my head. Yeah, so.
So if we have a, this is going to be great for the listeners.
Right.
We have.
At least that way I understand that.
A pentagon like this, and I can go round.
Okay.
Like that.
And it looks like a five-point star.
Yeah.
For the listeners. Okay.
And it has a name. It's the pentagram. Mm-hmm. And has a lot of people regard it as having spiritual significance.
Right.
It was actually a symbol for Jesus up until the 15th or 16th centuries, where it then became associated with Satanism. Mm-hmm. So there's some interesting connotations there to this form.
Wow.
So, but it's the first, I think that one of the reasons this symbol becomes important, you know, is given importance by people, is that it's the smallest to have a property.
Okay.
And I think one of the reasons five people feel it turns up in a lot of places is because it is a small number. And so there are things that just happen to be five, like, you know, having five fingers. There's nothing special about five. It's just what we happen to have, what evolution happens to have given us. So
it seems easier to use than, say, four or six.
It certainly feels more random, I think.
Yeah.
Because I think four or six, we see them as even
numbers. Even numbers, yeah.
And so they seem less important. Mm-hmm. Seven also turns up a lot for people because mm-hmm. it sort of seems like a slightly more arbitrary number. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the psychology of numbers becomes very interesting when you know what people. So magicians often use the fact that if you ask people for a random number between 1 and 10, they'll go for 7. We're getting distracted from 5. But.
Well, what about the Roman numeral for 5 is V?
Yeah.
And you see that often through, or you see it repeated, I guess, through the whole entire Roman numeral system.
Yeah.
5, V,
I think it's again to do with our hands.
Okay.
Imagine, you know, you've got the first 4 marks on your 4 fingers. And then if you hold up your hand and hold your fingers together, you get a V,
mm-hmm.
the fingers and the thumb.
Well, there you go. I just keep saying that, yeah. Okay.
I think the other geometrically interesting thing is that there are 5 regular polyhedra in 3 dimensions. And so these are, it's quite easy to look at the regular shapes in 2 dimensions. You can just take any number of sides and create something that's regular. You create the shape where every angle is the same and every edge is the same. So you get the equilateral triangle, the square, the regular pentagon, the regular hexagon, and so on. But in 3 dimensions, there's a lot more constraint, and you actually only have 5 figures where every vertex is the same, every face is the same, and all the edges are the same length. And that, you know, so there's exactly 5 of those. This is where we really need models and pictures. But but one of those, which is called the dodecahedron, is actually made of pentagons. So if you take pentagons, regular pentagons, and start putting them together, edge to edge, they will fit together. But on when you put them on the plane, you can draw 2 together. You can put in a third, and it leaves a little gap. And if we allow ourselves away from the plane into 3 dimensions, you can join those 3 pentagons together to create 3 coming together at a corner.
Do we see? You know, we keep bringing up that it has to do with our hands. Can you think of other places that we see 5 things, like in nature or biology?
The best example in biology is when you cut an apple in half. If you cut an apple in half, you always get 5. You always see 5 chambers going round.
Okay.
You get this sort of 5-fold symmetry. You think of an apple being a sphere, a sphere with top and bottom. So maybe it's sort of circular. But when you cut it open, you suddenly get 5-fold symmetry instead of the infinite symmetry of the circles.
I often actually have an apple in my desk. I look over there because that's where my normally keeps my snack stash is on my desk. But I mean, when you look down on an apple, it kind of seems like maybe you see that, you know, because you're kind of, I don't know, maybe not.
It's very clear from inside.
The bottom,
I think it
yeah.
then depends on how the apple's grown mm-hmm. on the outside.
Yeah, or maybe the bottom. I don't know. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Edmund Harris is a math professor at the University of Arkansas.
And as you mentioned at the beginning of your conversation about the number 5, Christina, it is Cinco de Mayo today.
It is May 5th.
Fifth day of the 5th month. So my inspiration for building a montage this week, the number 5. Thank you.
keep a job. I gotta find my way through the hustle and mob. The sounds of the city pounding in my brain while another day goes down the drain. But it's a 5 o'clock world when the whistle blows.
The advice of counsel, I respectfully assert my rights remain solid and decline to answer your question.
Multiplying by five is a little like counting by five. In fact, if you counted along on your fingers as you counted out loud by fives, your fingers would tell you how many fives you've got. Okay, let's count together now. Count on your fingers. One finger for each count out loud. Get set, ready, go. 5, 10, 15, 20, stop.
There is still a way we can help her.
What do you mean?
Kill her.
Yes. I want the Anti-Terrorist Committee to declare special powers.
Toaster of some kind?
I don't make the rules.
Okay, I'll make it as easy for you as I can. I'd like an omelet, plain, and a chicken salad sandwich on wheat toast. No mayonnaise, no butter, no lettuce, and a cup of coffee.
For number two, chicken salad sand. Hold the butter, the lettuce, the mayonnaise, and a cup of coffee. Anything else?
Yeah, now all you have to do is hold the chicken, bring me the toast, give me a check for the chicken salad sandwich, and you haven't broken any rules.
One, two, three, four, five, everybody in the car.
Book 'em, Dano.
If you would like to see the sources of those 10 clips saluting the number 5, you can go to ozarksatlarge.com.
One day, Sugata Mitra took a computer and he stuck it in a wall in a neighborhood in New Delhi.
Just to see what would happen if I gave a computer to children who never would have one, didn't know what the internet was.
And the results? Well, in 9 months, those kids
would reach the same standard as an office secretary in the West.
Untaught learning. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, just ahead at noon here on KUAF.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Figure 5.
Okay, that's so awesome. Where is Figure 5?
Figure 5. I was in Figure 5 not that long ago. It is on Highway 59.
Okay.
And it is almost exactly halfway between Cedarville and Van Buren.
Okay.
So if you're traveling south, you'd go through Cedarville, then Figure 5, then Van Buren.
And then Figure 5. Okay, how many people do you think live in Figure 5?
Well, more than five. More than five. I mean, it's a community.
Yeah.
But
all right.
But, you know, not huge. Yeah.
Okay.
An odd weekend.
It was an odd weekend. I know.
Some of the things happened. Some didn't. All because of cold weather and snow, which you don't expect in May.
No, definitely not. I think it was the first recorded snow in May.
First, what the
accumulation?
Yes. And granted, now, you know, Jamie Stone, who we heard earlier in the show, he's a native Canadian. So, you know, when he came in Friday and I said, oh, you're here on a historic day, the first measurable snow in the history of Fayetteville in May. And he said, and being completely sincere, he said, that was measurable. So, right.
Yeah.
We get it. But it's so rare here. But yes, it was the first measurable accumulation of snow recorded in May. In Fayetteville.
And so, yes, several things had to move indoors yesterday.
Right. Foam Fest went inside. Old Crow Medicine Show was postponed. Spring Fest has been postponed to perhaps a later date. First Friday in Bentonville was canceled. A lot of things had to change on the fly.
Yeah. Unfortunate, but.
But now here's the good news about Artisphere. It's just getting going. Tomorrow night at Thorn Crown Chapel, as we mentioned, Jamie Stone's Room of Wonders. Boy, if there are any tickets left, I'm going to jump on that. And then Tuesday night at the Cooper Chapel in Bella Vista.
Right, the Mildred Cooper Chapel, yeah.
Threepenny Acre and Gregory Alan Isakoff.
Which I'm going to. I managed to, yeah, I called my mom and said, this is something we need to do.
That is a sellout.
Right.
That has sold out. Then Wednesday night, Gregory Alan Isakoff will be at George's, as will Threepenny Acre, and then Lizzie Lehman, who we're going to hear on Ozarks at Large tomorrow with Antoinette Grajeda at noon and 7 p.m.
And she'll be at George's too?
She'll be opening at George's Wednesday night, and you can hear her perform a song called The Arctic tomorrow on Daily Ozarks at Large. So that's all happening in the week coming up. Also on Monday's edition, your story with David Staley.
Yes, about tree rings, yeah.
And then Joe Neal will also be on there with his latest bird essay. So a lot on Monday show at noon and 7, Daily Ozarks at Large.
Had a lot of nature and a lot of arts, which is so fitting.
That's right.
Artisphere, birds, yes. Tree rings, all this and all this music right. And stuff. So
brand new shows all week coming up at noon.
All right. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Have a good Sunday.